Astori Publishing presents Dawn of Defiance, Prologue. Long before dawn swept over the Dnipro on the 24th of February, 2022, Kiev lived inside an ordinary winter hush. Snow muffled the cobblestones around St. Sophia's bell tower. Traffic lights blinked red to empty intersections. A baker on Desyatina Street proofed loaves for the early crowd of office workers. Then, somewhere past 4 in the morning, the sky fractured. Cruise missiles arced out of the Black Sea. Radars along Ukraine's southern coast fell blind all at once, and the country discovered it had stepped without warning into the largest European war since the guns of 1945 fell silent. From that instant, this story begins, radiating outward in voices and decisions that would remake a continent. In a bunker beneath the presidential compound, Volodymyr Zelensky anchored those voices. Western capitals had offered him an airlift, but aides watching his face understood the reply before he spoke. Evacuation would teach Moscow the first lesson it wished to impose, that Ukraine was decapitated, and that lesson could not be allowed. He stayed, recorded a short video on a dimly lit street beside his closest ministers, and in doing so preserved a chain of command the Kremlin had banked on severing within hours. North of the capital, a local train conductor stood beside her stalled carriage at the Irpin River crossing. Rail control had cut power when the first explosions rattled the suburbs, yet she used the long wait to photograph license plates on military trucks snarled in the same traffic jam as her stranded passengers. By sundown, those images flowed through an encrypted channel to territorial defense volunteers who did not know her name, and artillery units kilometers away used the coordinates to aim at fuel tankers near the back of the convoy. The strike did not stop the offensive, but it slowed it, the first drip in a cascade that would bleed momentum from whole battalions. Far to the west, a senior diplomat inside NATO headquarters watched real-time satellite feeds flicker across three wall-mounted screens. He could see the convoy's mile-long tail of headlights and the flare blooms from Kyiv's northern suburbs. Yet what captured his attention was a smaller square of footage, a scattering of phone lights in a Kharkiv apartment block as residents, minutes after impact, posted fresh evidence of the attack. If civilians under bombardment could still push video to the outside world, then Ukrainian bandwidth and resolve remained intact. The Alliance emergency line rang less than an hour later, opening a chain of deliberations that would soon authorize the first flights of anti-armor missiles toward the Polish border. In Washington, an intelligence analyst assigned to European plans compared call sign chatter recorded over Belarus with an intercepted logistics manifest. Numbers did not match. The fuel on hand was too thin for a sprint to Kyiv and back. The mismatch hinted at a flaw baked into the entire Russian timetable. When the analyst typed a final paragraph into her briefing note, sustainment assumptions appear overly optimistic. She could not know that the sentence would travel upstairs and reinforce a White House decision to release classified imagery of Russian staging areas. That public disclosure, unprecedented in its speed, preempted Kremlin denials and rallied hesitant legislators who still doubted Ukraine's capacity to fight. Each of these vignettes unfolded within the first 48 hours, yet together they outlined the central puzzle that drives this book. How did an army that observers judged outgunned turn initial shock into an engine of adaptation? And what does that feat mean for every nation that assumed large-scale land war in Europe belonged to archives? The answers, teased but not settled in these pages, reach beyond frontline tactics. They live in ad hoc drone workshops inside suburban garages, in emergency off-ramp votes on defense spending inside parliamentary chambers, and in the uncomfortable recalculations now reshaping NATO's eastern flank. Across the Russian border, planners inside the National Defense Management Center in Moscow also sensed the timetable slipping. Field reports spoke of bridges down that were never on the target list, and ambushes guided by civilians who ought to have fled. An officer thumbed through mission folders stamped Special Military Operation, and wondered whether the label itself, chosen to mask the war's scale from domestic audiences, had bred complacency in the columns now halted by blown culverts. He ordered reserve fuel trucks forward under cover of darkness, unaware that commercial satellites could read heat signatures even through overcast sky. By the first Monday of the war, the initial race for Kyiv was already tilting toward stalemate. Yet nowhere along the three major axes did exhaustion mean quiet. In southern Ukraine, naval infantry brigades seized the city of Kherson in a textbook thrust up the Dnipro, convincing some commentators that the capital might still fall. In the east, armored spearheads broke through familiar Donbass front lines and threatened to pinch off whole Ukrainian brigades. But each gain revealed the same pattern. Once the lead vehicles halted, townspeople with smartphones filled the silence, mapping turning circles and fuel dumps in real time for gunners waiting over the horizon. Every village, it seemed, had discovered its own way to say no. By week's end, cargo aircraft began landing at airfields in southeastern Poland every 4 hours, offloading pallets of medical kits, radio jammers, and shoulder-fired missiles that ground crews hustled onto flatbed trucks bound for clandestine crossings. The quantities were still modest, barely a trickle compared to what the war would later consume, but they signaled a shift more durable than any single firefight. European finance ministers who had for years trimmed defense budgets now pushed emergency bills through midnight sessions, and the ruling question in Brussels was no longer whether aid would continue, but how quickly railheads could absorb it. The listener stands on that threshold now. Ukraine's skyline still burns in the night, Russian positions continue to burrow into steppe and forest, and diplomats shuttle between capitals seeking a ceasefire that remains elusive. Yet beneath the smoke, deeper currents move. The resurrection of territorial defense along the whole NATO rim, the renaissance of artillery doctrines suddenly relevant again, the redefinition of how civilians, code, and satellites can fuse into a reconnaissance web powerful enough to blunt a mechanized assault. This prologue lights only the opening frame. Ahead lie chapters that will march from the frozen highway north of Kyiv to the mine-littered fields of Zaporizhia, from the echoing stairwells of Bakhmut to the packed conference rooms where diplomats hunt for statesmanlike exits. What began with a pre-dawn strike has become a war of adaptation, and the measure of that change, its cost, its innovation, its warning, awaits you in the pages that follow. End of prologue. February 24th, 2022 broke over Ukraine in a hush that lasted only seconds. Then came the ripple of cruise missile launches streaking from the Black Sea, the roar of attack helicopters skimming treetops north of Kyiv, and a sudden bloom of electronic interference that crashed bank sites and government portals almost simultaneously. The Kremlin had ordered coordinated air, land, and cyber strikes at dawn, convinced that shock and speed would topple the elected authorities in Kyiv before most of the world finished its morning coffee. Nothing on the continent had approached that breadth of violence since the guns fell silent in 1945, and Europeans who awoke to sirens sensed with visceral clarity that they were witnessing the opening of the largest war on their soil since the Second World War. Russian planners envisioned three converging thrusts. The northern column pushed south from Belarus toward the capital, banking on a sealed border crossing and a highway that ran straight into the governmental quarter. A southern wing rolled out of occupied Crimea, aiming to seize coastal cities and carve a land bridge to the already smoldering Donbass. In the east, armor and mechanized infantry surged across familiar front lines in Luhansk and Donetsk, counting on established depots and sympathetic auxiliaries to speed their advance. The intent was political decapitation, cripple communications, encircle the leadership, raise a replacement flag within days, and confront a stunned world with a fait accompli. Yet within the first 48 hours, the anticipated collapse failed to materialize. President Volodymyr Zelensky and his cabinet remained in the capital, broadcasting from recognizable interiors that confirmed their physical presence and unbroken command chain. the continuity of leadership proved decisive because Ukrainian headquarters could still issue coherent orders, refute disinformation in real time, and rally an anxious populace that kept its smartphones trained on every column of smoke. Military historians would later single out this uninterrupted political nerve center as the greatest surprise of the invasion's opening act. Equally unexpected was the spontaneity with which civilians filled defensive gaps. Local councils, veteran volunteers, and students who had never fired more than a starter pistol melted into improvised barricades, blocking armored vehicles on narrow northern roads and relaying geotagged sightings to officers they had never met. Footage authenticated by independent analysts shows residents of two small towns north of Kyiv dragging concrete sewer rings into the street and hurling Molotov cocktails from behind garden fences, forcing a battalion of armored personnel carriers to stall long enough for Ukrainian artillery to lock on. These self-organized pockets soon formalized into territorial defense units that, while lightly armed, multiplied the number of firing positions an invader had to consider with every kilometer of advance. Behind the frenetic street-level improvisation worked a quieter lattice of intelligence. Months before the first missile struck, schoolteachers, train conductors, and cafe owners had formed encrypted chats that funneled license plate numbers, troop counts, and rail yard photographs to regional headquarters. When columns finally rolled, Ukrainian gunners already possessed coordinates accurate to the width of a supermarket parking space. That hyper-local stream meshed with strategic tips from Western surveillance aircraft and satellites, allowing field batteries to ambush lead tanks, drop bridges at the precise moment convoys reached them, and reposition air defense radars before enemy suppression missions could find their mark. Even as Ukrainian units fought for oxygen on the approaches to Hostomel Airport, foreign capitals triggered emergency assistance mechanisms, dormant clauses first drafted after earlier crises, but never before activated on this scale. Cargo aircraft landed in neighboring countries within the week, and truck convoys ferried pallets of anti-armor missiles to distribution hubs that worked around the clock. This initial trickle of ammunition, medical kits, and fuel additives solidified into what would soon be a multi-layered pipeline of economic, humanitarian, and lethal aid, ultimately exceeding $380 billion in value, with nearly $118 billion earmarked specifically for weapons, munitions, and training by the time the war approached its second summer. The mix of leadership continuity, grassroots defense, fast-moving aid, and fused intelligence upended Moscow's confidence. Western agencies reviewing drone footage, intercepted calls, and the unexpected resilience of Ukrainian radio traffic publicly judged the first 48 hours a turning point, proof that Kremlin assumptions about national cohesion were fatally flawed. Those assessments mattered. They reassured hesitant parliaments that aid would not dissolve in a lost cause and signaled to wary investors that Ukraine still had an identifiable government capable of servicing debts and organizing reconstruction amid bombardment. Events afterward reinforced the lesson. By early April 2022, Russian battalion tactical groups pulled back from Kyiv Oblast in what the Kremlin branded a goodwill gesture, though satellite imagery showed scorched armor abandoned on roadsides and pontoon bridges dismantled under fire. Ukrainian forces pursued without overextending, a textbook study in disciplined exploitation that foreshadowed their later aptitude for counteroffensive warfare. The retreat shifted the focal point eastward, reigniting battles in the Donbass and setting the stage for a lengthy contest over towns such as Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. That grinding phase produced its own crucibles. Bakhmut, a city of modest strategic depth, morphed into a symbol of national resolve on both sides, drawing artillery salvos measured in tens of thousands per month and elevating the Wagner Group, whose recruiters scoured penal colonies for manpower to sustain frontal assaults. In those trenches, loitering munitions and jury-rigged quadcopters proved that even small technological leaps could shape battlefield psychology, a truth earlier glimpsed in ad hoc drone videos, but magnified manifold in the months to follow. the pendulum eventually swung back toward maneuver. On September 6, 2022, reinforced Ukrainian brigades punched through a seam near Balaklia, recapturing more than 8,000 square kilometers in 5 rapid days while deliberately bypassing fortified conurbations. A decision rooted in the same calculus that had guided February's roadblocks: speed and surprise over static confrontation. Radio intercepts authenticated by journalists recorded Russian officers arguing over who held authority for retreat, echoing the command and control confusion first observed when the grand invasion plan went awry. Success bred new challenges. When Kyiv launched a broader counteroffensive in June 2023 along the Zaporizhia and Donetsk axes, its forces discovered that Russian engineers had spent months constructing defensive belts several kilometers deep, their mine density surpassing prior Western estimates and slowing Ukrainian advances to sometimes mere tens of meters per day. Mines were hardly novel, but the scale and sophistication forced brigades fresh from combined arms courses in Germany and the United Kingdom to recalibrate towards systematic, casualty-conscious breaching operations rather than headline-grabbing thrusts. Through it all, the war remained a study in complex interdependence. Military capability forged by domestic resolve, tempered by technological adaptation, and exponentially amplified by international support networks. As the conflict moved toward its fourth calendar year, front lines in sectors like Avdiivka and Krimina stiffened into a provisional stalemate, even while both armies raced to prototype new drones and electronic warfare suites slated for mass production in the coming year. An illustration of how innovation can coexist with positional deadlock. Diplomacy tried to keep pace. Turkey, the African Union, and the Vatican each floated confidence-building proposals, but none has yet secured a formal ceasefire, leaving analysts to conclude that NATO force posture across the region will be rewritten for at least the next decade. All later chapters, counterblows in Kharkiv, siege lines at Bakhmut, minefields in Zaporizhia, and diplomatic shuttle runs from Ankara to Rome, trace their lineage to the rupture at dawn on February 24th. In that opening salvo, Russia sought to paralyze Ukraine before resistance could cohere. Instead, the strike jolted an entire society into coordinated motion. Every subsequent development, triumphant, tragic, or simply instructive, flows from that first morning when assumption collided with actuality and the largest European conflict since our grandparents' era exploded into being. The story of that moment, its immediate shock and its cascading consequences, is where our narrative begins, and now does. Moscow's general staff titled their masterstroke a special military operation, and documents captured from wrecked command vehicles in the first week reveal why the phrasing mattered. The plans mapped a three-axis blitz designed to break the Ukrainian state before political and social antibodies could mobilize. Arrow 1 was to run south from Belarus along the MO7 highway straight into Kyiv's Maidan district, with armored spearheads scheduled to link up at the presidential compound no later than 72 hours after crossing the frontier. Arrow 2 was to sweep north and west from occupied Crimea, its naval infantry brigades ordered to seize the Black Sea littoral, choke commerce through Odessa, and create a land bridge to the smoldering Donbass enclaves. Arrow 3 was to push west from Rostov-on-Don through trench-scarred Donbass terrain, counting on separatist fortifications to serve both as springboard and rear security. The cumulative intent, stated bluntly in intercepts, was political decapitation by speed. "Take Kyiv fast, the rest will fold," read one summary slide later published by investigative journalists. Publicly, however, Kremlin spokespeople denied aiming for a 72-hour conquest. On day two, a spokesperson told reporters that operations were proceeding according to plan without specifying a timeline, and on day five, the defense minister insisted there was never an intention to storm major cities outright, a claim hard to square with convoy photographs filling global news feeds. That dissonance revealed an early fracture between the war Moscow advertised and the war it had programmed into its logistics tables. Inside Ukraine, the fracture became visible in kilometers, or rather in their absence. Northern advance units confronted forests and waterways, but terrain was less obstructive than the human grid already humming across it. For months, local volunteers had compiled transport schedules, vehicle rosters, and drone snapshots into encrypted rooms ready for instant upload to regional headquarters. When the Russian columns rolled, Ukrainian gunners received firing coordinates accurate to within the breadth of a supermarket parking space. That crowdsourced precision fused with overhead imagery and electronic intercepts supplied by Allied aircraft loitering just outside Ukrainian airspace. A data marriage that let batteries of Soviet-era howitzers land bracketed salvos on three separate convoys almost simultaneously. The effect cascaded. A single stalled platoon on the E-40 forced dozens of following vehicles to idle in tight intervals, their engines guzzling fuel far faster than logisticians had planned. When the roadblock finally burned, drones live-streamed the blaze, and residents downstream hastily dragged makeshift barricades across narrower feeder roads. What looked like civic chaos was, in practice, a homegrown reconnaissance strike complex. By nightfall of the second day, none of the three arrowheads had reached its phase-line objective. The blitz designed to seize the capital in 72 hours was bleeding tempo at every village intersection. Analysts will debate whether the invasion's flaw lay in intelligence, arrogance, or arithmetic, but the record is clear on adaptation. Ukrainian units turned local knowledge and global support into a coherent defense, an agility that outside observers soon recognized as the hallmark of the national response. Within 72 hours, the United States and several European governments were feeding real-time satellite updates to Kyiv. Within a week, cargo aircraft touched down with the first pallets of shoulder-fired missiles, sowing the seeds of what would become more than $380 billion in aggregate aid over the following 2 years, including nearly $118 billion for weapons, munitions, and training. Momentum, however, was rarely uniform. While the Northern Column bogged down, Arrow 2 from Crimea achieved early gains, capturing Kherson within the first week. Yet even there, triumph proved brittle. Partisan text chains reported every new checkpoint and supply depot, enabling strikes that rendered bridges over the Dnipro increasingly impassable. Arrow 3 in the Donbass enjoyed local guides, but progress slowed the farther troops advanced into less sympathetic territory, eroding the reliability of those guides. The elegant spreadsheet plan misread both Ukrainian morale and the power of popular resistance to reconfigure battlefield geometry. By mid-March, Western briefings could state openly that spearheads around Kyiv had stalled, citing satellite imagery of immobile vehicle lines and intercepted radio chatter begging for fuel and food. Ukrainian officers credited a wider ecosystem, civilian spotters, encrypted messaging, and drone-adjusted artillery, all orchestrated by a leadership that had refused evacuation planes on night one. That unbroken nerve center amplified every adaptive impulse already evident across society. Consequences radiated outward. Recognizing that the quick kill plan had failed, Russian commanders pivoted in early April, ordering a full withdrawal from Kyiv Oblast and redeploying battered groups eastward. Ukrainian brigades pursued but avoided overreach, preserving combat power for the Kharkiv counterstroke that began September 6th. That later offensive owed its speed to lessons first learned in February. Move quicker than the enemy can relay orders and never grant him a stable logistics pause. The next phase grew directly from that pendulum swing. The conflict morphed into a contest of endurance and innovation, with Bakhmut consuming artillery by the tens of thousands each month and introducing penal colony recruits to the front line. In June 2023, Ukraine launched a methodical offensive along multiple axes in Zaporizhia and Donetsk, unleashing brigades fresh from combined arms training. They soon found Russian engineers had carpeted open ground with mines at densities not seen since the Cold War, forcing a shift from lightning thrusts to deliberate breaching drills. As the war pushes toward its fourth calendar year, Front lines in sectors like Avdiivka and Kramina remain largely unchanged, even as both armies race to mass-produce new drone models and electronic warfare suites. Diplomatic channels float ceasefire frameworks, but none has secured agreement, underscoring how the conflict has already rewritten NATO's posture for at least the next decade. The three-pronged blitz was supposed to conclude the war before external support could flow and before local networks could connect village fences to satellite constellations. Instead, it revealed Ukraine's capacity for rapid adaptation and exposed the vulnerability of a numerically superior force when its timetable is deciphered and its logistics harassed. The crossroads at Hostomel Airport, once the spearhead of Moscow's northern thrust, fell silent during the night of April 1, 2022. Commercial satellites captured the change first. Convoys that had jammed the tree-lined approach roads for weeks were no longer emitting heat signatures, their silhouettes replaced by blackened hulls and cratered pavement. Over the next 72 hours, additional images showed empty positions around Bucha, Irpin, and across the northern arc of Kiev Oblast. Wherever the optics lingered, the pattern repeated. Hasty demolition of pontoon bridges, wheel tracks turning north toward Belarus, and fields strewn with scorched tanks left because they could not be dragged from the mud. Ukraine's general staff resisted the age-old temptation to chase a fleeing enemy at any cost. Infantry and territorial defense detachments probed to confirm the withdrawal, but high command orders limited forward elements to distances their logistics could sustain. Artillery observers concentrated on the tail end of the retreat, rather than risk flanking traps, and engineers paused often to clear mines. Russian rearguards had buried in village gardens. This measured tempo preserved brigade strength for future theaters and avoided the operational overreach that so often converts victory into stalemate. Inside the Kremlin press hall, the same reality acquired a different gloss. A spokesperson declared the pullback a goodwill gesture aimed at easing humanitarian corridors, repeating the phrase four times during a single televised appearance. Reporters on the ground filmed charred personnel carriers abandoned beside children's bicycles and apartment blocks scorched by recent shellfire, visual proof that departure followed hard fighting, not magnanimous scheduling. The debate mattered because it framed the next phase. By admitting, even obliquely, that Kyiv could not be taken, Moscow recast its objective in terrain that seemed more congenial, the east. Battalions short on vehicles but still manned were reflagged, replenished, and railed toward Donbass junctions. There they joined units already hardened by 8 years of skirmishing, massing to pry open Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, twin cities straddling the Seversky-Donetsk River. From early May through midsummer, those river bends echoed with artillery rhythms unheard in Europe since World War II. United Nations monitors logged a steady rise in civilian casualties, noting that many deaths occurred as residents queued for water or fled along the single highway that remained passable under fire. Ukrainian brigades maneuvered inside a tightening pocket, yet continued to inflict losses that forced Russian commanders to rotate entire battalions for refurbishing. Blitz had given way to attrition. The eastern focus did not erase broader stakes. Observers across Europe recognized that the conflict ignited on February 24th was the continent's largest confrontation since 1945. Ukraine's defense drew power from adaptability, knitting local knowledge, smartphone reconnaissance, and external aid into one responsive whole. That adaptability had blunted the push toward Kyiv. Now it retooled for factory ruins and wheat fields. International support deepened even as frontline priorities shifted. By midsummer, combined foreign assistance exceeded $380 billion, with nearly $118 billion set aside for weapons, munitions, and training. Supplies coursed through Polish railheads and Romanian ports toward depots in Dnipro and Kramatorsk, ensuring worn artillery tubes could be swapped rather than silenced. Russian planners, chastened by their northern failure, began stacking mass fires in overlapping curtains, accepting slow progress so long as each block seized stayed seized. Their approach produced the ghastly case study of Bakhmut, a city that would assume symbolic weight far beyond its tactical value. Artillery consumption there rose to tens of thousands of shells per month. Meanwhile, Kremlin reliance on the Wagner Group, a private formation recruiting from penal colonies, likewise amplified during this period. Ukrainian staff colleges absorbed lessons from the April withdrawals. The first takeaway was discipline. Every kilometer regained must be supplied, garrisoned, and scanned by drones. The second was tempo. Advances had to outstrip the enemy's ability to redeploy. Those doctrines would flower spectacularly 5 months later in Kharkiv Oblast, where a strike commencing on September 6th regained more than 8,000 square kilometers in 5 days. The shift eastward also accelerated technological competition. Quadcopters that neighborhood volunteers used in February to scout convoys were now fitted with improvised racks, turning hobby drones into trench bombers. Ukrainian officers soon refined the concept into factory-produced loitering munitions. Russian electronic warfare teams countered with jamming towers on armored trucks, sparking a contest of signal strength and frequency agility. Ukrainian engineers, meanwhile, drafted blueprints for the combined arms push they hoped to launch the following summer. Western instructors drilled new brigades on breaching tactics, mine roller employment, and rapid bridge laying, skills chosen precisely because intelligence indicated Russian defenders were strip mining likely approaches at densities few planners had seen since the Cold War. The broad arc traced by the April withdrawal yields a paradox. Moscow's retreat spared its troops the attrition of urban encirclement, yet freed Ukrainian formations to conserve strength, harvest aid, and refine offensive doctrine. The Donbas battles that followed were not an isolated sequel, but an evolution. Proof that in Europe's largest war of the century, momentum can migrate without vanishing. The episode also demonstrated the double-edged nature of narrative warfare. By portraying withdrawal as altruistic, Kremlin spokespeople sought to shield domestic audiences from failure, even as satellite evidence painted a contrary picture. Kyiv emphasized measured pursuit as evidence of maturing operational art, a tone that sustained Western confidence when parliaments debated aid packages. Severodonetsk and Lysychansk eventually fell after weeks of street fighting, yet even those gains left Russia short of its original objective: full control of the Donbas and leverage to dictate terms in Kyiv. The seesaw would swing again in September across Kharkiv's plains, then lock into the attritional vice of Bakhmut and later grind against Zaporizhia minefields. Each future turn traces back to April, when Ukrainian brigades shadowed a withdrawing foe rather than outrun their own supply lines, a choice that preserved force, sharpened doctrine, and quietly reset the chessboard. Kharkiv Oblast lay under the muted light of early autumn when the long-nursed Ukrainian counterstroke finally snapped into motion. Fields still carried August dust, and on many back roads, the only sound the night before the assault was the rustle of sunflower stalks brushing abandoned ration crates. To the untrained eye, it seemed a lull. To officers in Kyiv, the front already vibrated with preparatory fire. Weeks of high-mobility rocket salvos had been walking methodically across ammunition dumps and pontoon parks, carving holes in the supply web, feeding every battalion along the Seversky-Donetsk. By dawn on September 6th, the lattice of depots nourishing Russia's eastern grouping had been trimmed to 3 railheads and a handful of fuel points, each now within range of Western-donated launchers, whose crews rotated tubes so often that maintenance teams kept spare firing pins on blankets beside every rig. The main effort hinged on Balaklia, a modest town whose road net resembles a hinge connecting north-south and east-west arteries. In late August, reconnaissance units probed its checkpoints, logging fire control times and, crucially, plotting weapon calibers. Those thin sorties convinced planners that Russian defenders were spread in platoon islands rather than layered companies, partly because neighboring units had already pulled skeleton crews south toward the Zaporizhia axis, where Kyiv had been advertising an offensive of its own. The feint worked, and by mid-morning September 6th, the outer ring around Balaklia crumbled in hours, not days. Forward observers reported squad leaders searching radio channels for a battalion net that had shifted frequency without notice. Captured traffic records, an exasperated officer snarling, "Who signs the retreat order? Nobody is picking up." Velocity mattered more than headcount. Ukrainian columns throttled northeast after punching through, leaving Balaklia's municipal buildings to follow on infantry, while spearheads raced along the P-78 highway toward Shevchenkov. Declassified fragments show orders that stressed bypass over battle. Avoid fortified conurbations, seize junctions that could break the enemy's map. Open-source cartographers crowdsourced drone stills, social media clips, and satellite snapshots. By the morning of September 8th, overlays circulating online showed blue arrows cascading toward the Oskil River. Several think tanks independently calculated that more than 2,000 square kilometers had flipped control in 48 hours, a pace unseen since the invasion's first week, and one that only accelerated when Kupiansk fell on September 10th. Kupiansk's capture was more rail seizure than street fight. Parallel tracks funnel ammunition north from Belgorod before branching toward Izium and Lyman. Concentrated precision rocket fire crippled the junction in minutes, severing the lifeline feeding Russian forces across the eastern shelf. Western officials later credited the strikes to U.S. high-mobility rocket systems, arguing that neutralizing Kupiansk removed the ballast from Russia's entire defensive arc east of Kharkiv. Across deoccupied fields, civilians emerged clutching notebooks, crammed with 10 months of observations, license plates, guard rotations, even approximate shell counts. This grassroots intelligence, the same circuitry that slowed February's invasion, once again amplified national combat power by gifting commanders granular detail they could never collect alone. The counteroffensive fused two virtues: national scale, supplied by Western munitions, and local intimacy, supplied by residents who had waited nearly a year to reopen barns for hidden radio repeaters. In 5 days, Kyiv announced the recapture of more than 8,000 square kilometers, a figure cross-checked against commercial imagery by independent analysts and accepted as broadly accurate once irregular bulges were smoothed for mapping. President Zelensky's nightly addresses cited liberated settlements by name, often brandishing unit insignia recovered from village halls to dramatize the speed of change. International audiences thrilled at commentators calling it the most agile maneuver on European soil since armored columns thundered across Kuwait, yet Ukrainian briefings remained calm, describing the sprint as merely phase one of a campaign to collapse the entire Izium salient. Operational calm belied chaos inside Russian headquarters. Intercepts captured mid-level officers debating which chain of command they now answered after rapid losses severed lateral links. Some units withdrew toward the Oskil in reasonable order, others dissolved, abandoning artillery pieces and crates of mortar rounds in tree lines. Ukrainian logistics troops recovered fuel and ammunition left behind, powering the very vehicles now racing east, a real-time inversion of intent that planners could scarcely script. Euphoria soon met the physics of sustainment. Bridges across the Oskil had been pre-ranged by Russian gunners, and as Ukrainian vanguards reached each crossing, the hiss of incoming shells returned. Engineers patched roadway craters with fastens and scavenged metal decking, but the river slowed the chase enough for Moscow's battered battalions to reconstitute. By mid-September, drones showed Russian trench squads welding steel angles across likely Ford sites, foreshadowing the static lines that would later harden from Kremina down to Svatove. The Kharkiv thrust, nevertheless, rewrote morale calculus on both sides. In Moscow, military bloggers who had championed the war's inevitability erupted in self-recrimination, hammering the defense ministry for underestimating Ukrainian maneuver skill. In Kyiv, success vindicated a year of emphasis on tempo and precision rather than head-on sieges, confirming that strikes on logistic choke points can unhinge a front faster than battering rams applied to city blocks. Western capitals noted the contrast with Severodonetsk. What attrition eked out in weeks, maneuver seized in days. Public appetite for aid stayed strong. The aggregate commitment had already exceeded $380 billion, with nearly $118 billion tagged for weapons, munitions, and training. The September breakthrough accelerated deliveries of spare barrels, bridging assets, and demining rollers, gear deemed essential if Kyiv were to replicate the Kharkiv model elsewhere. Planners in Berlin and Washington reasoned that a defender capable of retaking 8,000 square kilometers in a week merited deeper investment. Ukrainian commanders tempered optimism with arithmetic. Engineers had already cleared significant minefields near Balaklia, a warning that Russian manuals preach retreat while salting ground. The pattern predicted that any future offensive toward the Zaporizhia corridor would wade through belts at least as dense, a forecast that shaped breaching syllabi later taught on German and British ranges. The Kharkiv lightning, glorious in pace, therefore ceded its own caution. Speed remains king, but only when paired with tools that can outwit layered obstacles. Liberated territory also exposed grim indicators of occupation abuses. Investigators reported evidence of unlawful confinement and hastily dug burial sites in several towns, reminders that regained ground carried both strategic and humanitarian imperatives. By late September, the front stabilized roughly along the Oskol River and the edge of Lyman's forests. Analysts debated why the advance paused. Some pointed to logistical stretch. Others noted autumn rains turning fields into paste. Kyiv's official line was succinct. Combat power must be husbanded for the next phase. Inside planning rooms, a map of Zaporizhia already glittered with colored pins, many marking suspected mine belts that intelligence warned were denser than any measured in Europe this century. From the vantage of history, the Kharkiv counteroffensive will stand as a case study in maneuver driven by intelligence fusion, local initiative, and precision logistics interdiction. It drew upon the same ingredients that had allowed Ukraine to survive the invasion's first shock: grassroots networks, swift foreign armament, and candid leadership, yet distilled them into an operational tempo that surprised even friendly analysts. Success did not end the war, nor did it eliminate the attritional slugfests that would later grind across Bakhmut's ruins. But it proved decisively that Russian gains since April were neither fixed nor beyond reversal. The episode amplified a larger lesson. Adaptability can offset disparities in raw mass. Russia still commanded larger stockpiles of artillery and armor, but Ukraine's ability to sense, decide, and strike faster along the Kharkiv axis allowed brigades of modest size to fracture a front supposedly anchored by seasoned units. For students of military science, September 6th through 12th will become required reading, a modern echo of textbook armored operations. For residents of Balaklia, Kupiansk, and dozens of villages rarely marked on global maps, those days were simpler. They were the week the war receded, with astonishing abruptness, the week sunflower fields once more sounded, only with wind and the distant rumble of an army pushing east. The road that threads eastward from Kramatorsk into Bakhmut is neither straight nor grand. It bends around low slag heap hills, crosses two modest rivers, and runs past sunflower fields laid flat by shell bursts. As the previous section foreshadowed, militarily, the route offers little more than another entry point to a middling rail junction and a handful of salt mine shafts. Yet from late summer 2022 through the following spring, that narrow ribbon became the funnel through which two armies poured ambition, artillery, propaganda, and lives in amounts few imagined when the first volleys landed. The battle opened quietly by Donbass standards. In August, Russian reconnaissance drones captured images of Ukrainian engineering squads reinforcing berms on Bakhmut's eastern outskirts. By September, after the Ukrainian lightning strike in Kharkiv, Moscow sought a narrative counterweight. planners redrew operational priorities, and Bakhmut, midway between the contested cities of Slovyansk and the administrative border of Luhansk, offered a target close enough to threaten wider lines yet small enough to advertise quick victory. Ukrainian staffs saw the same map but reached a different conclusion. The town was a cork in the bottle, guarding lateral roads deeper into Donetsk. Both headquarters therefore staked prestige on ground whose practical value lay mainly in the headlines it might generate. Artillery thunder announced the escalation. United States officials observing expenditure patterns estimated that shell fire around Bakhmut alone reached into the tens of thousands of rounds each month, a rate comparable to entire fronts in previous wars, but here concentrated on a municipality smaller than Des Moines. The numbers carried implications beyond noise and crater counts. Western logistic officers translated them into barrel burn rates, powder stockpiles, and resupply convoys that would have to snake across railheads already harassed by precision rockets. Russian officers, meanwhile, accepted the consumption in exchange for daily progress measured in city blocks. In planning cells on both sides of the front, the fight hardened into arithmetic. Close observers soon noticed a shift in the assault's human texture. Where regular Russian motor rifle regiments once spearheaded advances, new faces appeared. Men in mismatched camouflage, some bearing prison tattoos, others still wearing the plastic slip-on sandals issued in penal colonies. They belonged to the Wagner Group, the private formation helmed at the time by businessman Yevgeny Prigozhin, who had begun touring incarceration facilities with promises of amnesty and cash for service at the front. His pitch was blunt. Survive 6 months and sentences would vanish. Yet the chance of freedom lured thousands. Russian human rights monitors decried the practice, but recruitment continued, producing influxes of unseasoned riflemen thrown into so-called storm units tasked with probing Ukrainian trenches at night. Ukrainian defenders quickly nicknamed those nocturnal charges meat waves, a grim phrase that captured both the casualties inflicted and the psychological toll of repelling near-continuous infiltration attempts. Platoon after platoon of convicts advanced across mined tree lines, lit only by flare bursts, often navigating by the flashes of their own artillery rather than by ordered reconnaissance. The survivors gained experience fast. The fallen provided Wagner commanders data on which berms were wired with seismic sensors and where Ukrainian machine gun arcs overlapped. By winter, some analysts cited the city as evidence that Russia was willing to expend human reserves rarely seen in recent European wars, a demonstration of manpower usage entwined with Kremlin messaging far out of proportion to the map. Symbolism alone could not breach concrete. As temperatures dropped, both armies invested in trenches, revetments, and interlocking fields of fire that recalled the First World War, but with 21st century overlays. Small quadcopters, some bought retail and modified with fishing line detonators, hovered over foxholes to drop hand grenade-sized charges. Larger, loitering munitions, built in workshops on each side, orbited for hours before diving onto thermal signatures. Bakhmut thus evolved into a laboratory where tactics could be tested in real time against an alert enemy. Ukrainian sappers mounted night vision cameras on off-the-shelf drones, flew them at treetop height to find Russian electronic warfare emitters, then tasked artillery for follow-up strikes. Russian teams answered by calibrating jammers to sweep the unlicensed spectrum bands most hobby controllers used, forcing Ukrainian operators to shift frequencies like radio pirates in a cold sky. Field reports circulated through secure chats and Telegram channels, turning each evening's skirmish into the next morning's tutoring session for units elsewhere along the line. The city endured hammer blows. Satellite imagery from January 2023 recorded whole districts reduced to rubble, yet neither side ceded ground willingly. For Ukrainian brigades rotated in from quieter sectors, duty in Bakhmut carried a dual reputation, a guarantee of combat experience and a near-certain roster of casualties. Commanders mitigated burnout by cycling companies every 2 to 3 weeks, but the pressure remained relentless. Russian units, flush with Wagner manpower, sometimes pushed 3 or 4 assaults in 24 hours. Each gain was celebrated in state media as evidence that the meat grinder, an image popular on Russian nationalist blogs, was wearing down Ukrainian reserves. Strategists outside the theater questioned the math. Militarily, seizing Bakhmut would complicate Ukrainian supply routes, but would not automatically unlock a path to Slovyansk or Kramatorsk, both shielded by additional river lines and prepared defenses. Still, Moscow framed the objective as proof that perseverance could overcome Western aid. Kyiv responded in mirror image, holding the city would show that Russian offensives, even when massing artillery and disposable infantry, could be contained. The mutual fixation inflated every intersection into a referendum on national will. For those under fire, symbolism mattered less than terrain. On the ground floor of a collapsed schoolhouse, a Ukrainian platoon leader recorded coordinates of approaching footsteps on a paper map darkened by candle soot. Across the crossroads, a Wagner section leader radioed back building numbers captured, his voice competing with the clatter of incoming shell fragments. Neither commander could see the full front, yet both understood that each staircase mattered because someone far above them had declared it did. Artillery remained the arbiter. Ukrainian guns, arrayed in concentric belts west of the city, rationed shells carefully. Each tube fired less than its Russian opposite number, making up the deficit with better targeting data from NATO surveillance and civilian spotters texting photos from basement windows. Russian batteries answered with volume, sometimes blanketing entire neighborhoods to mask an infantry rush. Analysts tracking consumption estimated that Russian shell usage in the Bakhmut sector alone exceeded rates typical of previous European conflicts, a statistic that underscored how the war's attritional hinge had swung into grotesque scale. Ukrainian logisticians, in turn, rotated barrels to avoid premature rifling failure, a practice unfamiliar to armies unused to such sustained pace. By February 2023, the battle lines resembled a horseshoe. Russian forces had pressed north and south to envelop the town on 3 sides, leaving a single artery west through the village of Ivanivske as Ukraine's lifeline. Roadside berms along that corridor sprouted camouflage netting to conceal supply trucks, and engineers laid pontoon spans across culverts so that if one bridge cratered, another route could open within hours. Wagner squads, meanwhile, took the salt mine industrial zone, moving step by step through conveyor halls frozen by broken steam pipes. Each building captured became a forward observation post from which new assaults could be plotted. The siege narrative tightened, and global media began comparing Bakhmut to Verdun, Stalingrad, or other icons of attritional despair. Historians cautioned against direct analogy, yet the siege's hold on public imagination mirrored those earlier epics in intensity, if not in scale. Behind the smoke, technology cycles accelerated. Ukrainian coders wrote software patches that let commercial drones switch to encrypted links mid-flight, circumventing Russian jammers. Russian engineers countered with portable microwave emitters that fried circuit boards, forcing Ukrainian operators to adopt cheaper drones they could afford to lose. Each adaptation rippled outward. What worked in Bakhmut on Monday appeared in Avdiivka by Thursday, turning the city into a source code repository for modern small unit innovation. Western officers visiting Kyiv to discuss future aid packages requested after-action briefings focused less on terrain lost or gained and more on which electronic warfare suites had survived contact. Within Russia, casualty reports filtered back through unofficial channels. Mothers' groups posted names of sons last seen near Bakhmut. Some found no confirmation, neither on official manifests nor in hospital lists. Wagner administration rarely notified families of convict volunteers, arguing contracts were private. Human rights advocates published aggregate tallies they claimed to corroborate via morgue visits, prompting state broadcasters to dismiss the figures as foreign fabrication. The debate highlighted another asymmetry. Ukraine publicized its dead to reinforce societal commitment. Russia largely suppressed the numbers to shield policy. Both approaches fed the same furnace of symbolism. Spring thaw arrived. Mud-thickened trenches. Quadcopters skidded off makeshift plywood pads. Yet the shelling never paused. On certain April days, acoustic sensors logged such dense outgoing fire that analysts questioned whether Russian stocks could sustain the rate through summer. Aerial reconnaissance soon spied crates stamped with 1970s production dates, evidence that older inventories were being tapped to keep the barrage steady. Across the line, donors accelerated deliveries of standard artillery shells to sustain Ukraine's counter-battery fire. The escalation hinted that neither side would willingly de-escalate for fear of handing the other a narrative edge. By mid-May, Wagner detachments finally punched into the last high-rise cluster near the T-0500 highway, an achievement Yevgeny Prigozhin announced with a video filmed before the shattered Civic Center, his camouflage mud-spattered and his tone equal parts triumph and reproach toward the Russian Ministry of Defense. Ukrainian commanders conceded that holding a pocket now exposed to fire from 300 degrees risked encirclement. Phased withdrawals began, executed at night under cover of automated smoke generators. Roadblocks preloaded with thermite charges were detonated only after the last vehicle crossed. When the final Ukrainian flag came down on the eastern bank of the Bakhmutovka River in late May 2023, both governments rushed to claim the bigger point. Moscow said the capture proved its offensive capacity remained intact. Kyiv argued its defense had exhausted elite Wagner assault echelons, weakening Russia ahead of the summer counteroffensive. Objective analysts judged both lines partially true and partially rhetorical. The city, never a linchpin of broader maneuver, lay in ruin. Its rail spurs twisted, its salt mine conveyors shattered, its civilians evacuated or in graves. Yet the struggle had yielded intangibles. It had tested every artillery logistics concept both armies possessed, had exposed the limits of convict recruitment as a replacement strategy, and had accelerated drone electronic warfare evolution by months, if not years. Bakhmut, in other words, had become less a place than a crucible. For Ukraine, the siege offered a cautionary tale ahead of its Zaporizhia push. Staff colleges dissected after-action reports and concluded that even successful holding actions demanded prohibitive ammunition when the enemy accepted losses in open waves. For Russia, the episode illustrated how political necessity can distort operational logic. A moderate value objective hyped into an existential goal invites costs impossible to recoup elsewhere. The fields surrounding the town are silent again, save for sporadic crumps marking demining teams at work. Yet maps of the war cannot erase the contour Bakhmut etched onto strategy. Its story stands as the conflict's starkest example of symbolic inflation, where a settlement that mattered little in January came to dominate headlines by March and to consume tens of thousands of shells each month by winter. It is also the chapter that revealed the lengths to which Moscow would go to sustain momentum. Penal colony levies, massed artillery, and a private army eclipsing regular formations, choices that will shadow every later engagement as the war stretches toward another summer. The first week of June 2023 opened with low, dry heat across the Zaporizhia steppe. In the pine groves south of Orykiv and behind the wheat ridges near Velika Novosilka, newly formed Ukrainian assault brigades waited for a single, encrypted word to step off. Many of the soldiers wore unit patches only recently stitched at ranges in Germany and the United Kingdom, proof that months of Western-led combined arms courses had graduated classroom theory into rifle squads, tank platoons, and sapper detachments built for synchronized advance. Their equipment mix brought Leopards, Challengers, Bradley fighting vehicles, and an array of mine-clearing line charges intended to punch corridors through what intelligence described as the most elaborate defensive belts built on European soil since the Cold War. At 0200 on June 4th, a sequence of preparatory fires, visible from commercial weather satellites, walked southward across suspected Russian ammunition dumps. By dawn, armored columns began rolling. The main thrust aimed down the Tokmak-Melitopol axis, the shortest overland route to the Sea of Azov, while supporting attacks pressed east of Velika Novosilka and probed flanks near Bakhmut, a town still smoldering from the attritional furnace of the previous winter. Kiev's battle map called for rapid exploitation if the first line of trenches cracked, but planners paired that aspiration with a directive seldom heard in earlier offensives. Casualties were to be minimized even at the cost of tempo, an instruction born of lessons from the siege warfare that had devoured battalions around Bakhmut and Soledar. Within 24 hours, electronic intelligence aircraft orbiting over friendly territory confirmed what advance patrols already suspected. Vast stretches of ground ahead were laced with mines at densities far beyond earlier NATO worst-case tables. The pattern, verified pixel by pixel against shadow angles and thermal anomalies, forced an immediate recalibration. Instead of armored spearheads knifing through and fanning out, Ukrainian sappers now crept forward meter by meter, swinging handheld detectors and pulling drag rakes behind remote-controlled breaching vehicles whose plow blades sparked where steel met buried metal. Observers unused to mechanized warfare's arithmetic struggled with the resulting pace. On certain 10-kilometer frontages, whole companies advanced no more than a few dozen meters in a day, each step punctuated by the muffled thump of a detonated charge or the sharper crack of a command-wired mine triggered from a concealed bunker. Yet the caution paid dividends. Medical evacuation statistics released weeks later showed casualty rates lower than those suffered in the first fortnight of the Kharkiv lightning the previous autumn, evidence that engineering patience could blunt the enemy's scorched earth design. Russian commanders had structured the defense in belts rather than in a single Maginot-style wall. The first band combined minefields with prefabricated dragon's tooth pyramids, vehicle trenches, and concrete firing positions spaced for interlocking arcs. Behind that lay secondary and tertiary lines equipped with mobile reserves, all connected by hard-packed farm tracks, graded wide enough for ammunition trucks, but narrow enough to funnel any attacker into pre-sited artillery alleys. Satellite passes during May had captured bulldozers at work on these zones, but the sheer depth still surprised many Western analysts once the scale became evident under live fire. To keep momentum alive under those constraints, Ukrainian staffs leaned heavily on the intelligence architecture that had already defined the war. Reconnaissance drones, flown by crews who only months earlier had been programming mapping software in Lviv classrooms, now orbited over Russian rear areas to spot artillery batteries each time they unmasked to fire. The coordinates fed directly to counter-battery radars and then to tube and rocket artillery drawn from the nearly $118 billion in military aid committed by partner nations since the invasion's outset. Each Russian gun destroyed represented a small widening of the breach lanes. Sappers were hacking through the mine carpets. Logistics tethered everything. Diesel and bridge spans, medical gauze and drone batteries, all depended on the multinational pipeline whose cumulative valuation had, by the summer of 2023, exceeded $380 billion across economic, humanitarian, and lethal categories. Ukrainian officers at forward command posts could recite it almost as creed, aware that their ammunition expenditure reports traveled the same data lines that carried parliamentary debates in donor capitals. Counterfire soon became constant. Russian attack helicopters, operating just inside their own air defense umbrella, loosed guided rockets at demining vehicles each time a plume of displaced soil marked progress. Ukrainian air defense teams answered with infrared missiles launched from tree lines, while electronic warfare detachments jammed navigation signals to throw off incoming glide bombs. The exchange illustrated an axiom already proven outside Kiev in the invasion's opening days. Resistance that fuses local initiative with high-grade external inputs can neutralize advantages in raw firepower. Geography imposed its own schedule. The Tokmak Road snakes through shallow valleys that funnel floodwater whenever summer storms break, and on the eighth day of the operation, a downpour soaked topsoil, turning cleared paths into viscous bog. Combat engineers laid corduroy mats hacked from orchard timber to prevent armored tracks from spinning, a solution reminiscent of Second World War manuals, and a reminder that modern sensors do not erase timeless terrain. Western commentators next turned to comparative history, some invoking the sweeping maneuvers of 2022's Kharkiv offensive, others warning that a mine-laden steppe could not be unpicked at the same speed as lightly held woodland valleys. Ukrainian spokespeople countered with transparency. Daily briefs published photographs of captured Russian trenches, annotated with grid references and timestamps. Pentagon officials, in on-background press sessions that September, endorsed that framing, describing Ukrainian gains as incremental but strategically coherent, and cautioning against declaring an operation stalled when primary assault brigades had yet to reach the second belt in force. Inside planning cells, adaptation accelerated. Drone footage showed that large armored groupings drew immediate artillery response, so battalion commanders dispersed vehicles, advancing in checkerboard patterns, with infantry remounting only after a safe lane had been swept. Night assaults increased, leveraging Western-supplied thermal sights to let sappers work under cover of darkness where Russian optics were fewer. The brigades also fielded small teams equipped with ground-penetrating radar procured through private donations, a civilian technology repurposed to locate plastic-cased mines invisible to magnetic detectors. Casualty-conscious breaching demanded ammunition types Kyiv did not initially possess in bulk. By midsummer, several donor states authorized delivery of cluster artillery rounds, the rationale being that submunitions could shred trench berms and thin minefields more efficiently than high-explosive unitary shells. Human rights advocates voiced concern. Ukrainian officials argued that every additional Russian obstacle removed by indirect fire saved Ukrainian soldiers from walking into it. Strategically, even small penetrations mattered because of what they threatened. Were Ukrainian armor to punch through the third defensive band and reach the rail hub at Tokmak, the single rail line feeding Russian formations in southern Ukraine would fall within sustained artillery range. Planners in Moscow understood the vulnerability and rotated airborne reserves to threatened sectors by helicopter, trading mobility for the risk of flying under edge-of-envelope Ukrainian air defense coverage. Meanwhile, international observers kept an eye on the attritional ledger. Ukraine's broader society already celebrated for adaptability that had fused civilian ingenuity with military requirement ever since villagers' live-streamed tank columns in February 2022 was again improvising. Agricultural tractors hauled disabled fighting vehicles from mine lanes during lulls. Local metallurgists welded replacement plow teeth onto breaching tanks. And traffic police drones repurposed for battlefield surveillance filled gaps when military quadcopters were in maintenance. The wider world judged progress against expectations, and those expectations had been inflated by the cinematic sweep of Kharkiv the year before. By late July, some commentators pronounced the push underwhelming. Ukrainian leaders replied by pointing to minefield photographs taken from orbital and tactical sensors, explaining that every white scar on the imagery represented explosives powerful enough to amputate a tank's running gear. August brought incremental breakthroughs. South of Robotyne, assault groups flagged a lane wide enough to funnel an entire mechanized company through without triggering fresh detonations. The village itself, reduced to basements and broken gables, fell after house-to-house fights, measured not in days, but in 100-meter segments. Russian drone feeds caught the fireballs, and reserve battalions were ordered forward to plug gaps. Each such redeployment drained Moscow's operational reserve pool. By mid-September, Ukrainian advance elements had breached the second defensive belt in at least one sector, though official communiques withheld precise coordinates. Pentagon analysts briefed reporters that Kyiv's methodical approach was logistics aware, a phrase meaning ammunition consumption, vehicle losses and medical evacuation rates were being kept within margins that allowed the offensive to continue without strategic pause. The harsh arithmetic of mine breaching had forced that discipline. Every detonation served as both hazard and metric, marking progress in charred craters rather than sweeping arrows on a map. Whether the summer operation ultimately fulfills its grand design is a question for future chapters. What can be recorded as fact is that Ukrainian planners translated the attrition lessons of Bakhmut into a doctrine of cautious resolve, that Russian engineers imposed a mine density rarely seen in modern war, and that the international community sustained financial and material flows on a scale once reserved for global conflagrations. Those realities converge in the dusty corridors north of Tokmak, where every meter of cleared earth represents not just tactical ground, but the sum of training fields in Bavaria, appropriations bills in Washington, solidarity concerts in Warsaw, and the uncounted civilian acts that steady a nation determined to reclaim what was taken. The summer counteroffensive thus stands as an inflection rather than a culmination. It is proof that maneuver in 21st century Europe demands more than courage and armor. It demands algorithms, orbital reconnaissance, economic coalitions, and a sober respect for how a well-laid mine can halt even the most sophisticated tank. Above all, it reminds historians in real time that adaptability, the trait that saved Kyiv in the war's first week and underwrote Kharkiv's liberation in its second autumn, remains Ukraine's defining strategic resource, one that shows no sign of depletion. Snow now dusts the shell craters outside of Avdiivka, and when the wind drops, one can sometimes hear dogs barking in the gray distance. Evidence that life, however muted, persists along a front that satellite imagery shows has scarcely budged since late autumn 2023. The United Nations situation map for January traces virtually the same jagged contact line it published 3 months earlier, confirming that neither side has rested more than a village block in this sector or around the forested approaches to Crimea, despite nightly exchanges of artillery and reconnaissance drones. Stagnation, though, is a relative term. Viewed from the air, both armies continue to scrape fresh trenches into the topsoil, string new fiber optic cables, and test jamming algorithms that did not exist when the fighting began. The front may be static in kilometers, but it is in flux in code. Coalition support remains the pulse enabling that code. Western legislatures have now appropriated more than $380 billion in aggregate assistance, with nearly $118 billion of that sum ring-fenced for weapons, munitions, and training packages, stretching into 2025. Much of the money never enters Ukraine in banknotes. It arrives as pallets of air defense interceptors, replacement barrels for self-propelled howitzers, and instructor teams rotating through polygons in Germany and the United Kingdom, the very ranges that forged the combined arms brigades unleashed on the Zaporizhia steppe last June. Finance ministries from Ottawa to Oslo describe the outlays as multi-year guarantees, a vocabulary chosen to reassure Kyiv that political turnovers in donor capitals will not snap the lifeline mid-campaign. In effect, the coalition has institutionalized a wartime lend-lease for the digital age, one that funnels precision components as readily as diesel fuel. Yet the battlefield arithmetic that money seeks to influence has grown harsher. Russian engineers spent the winter reseeding fields with anti-tank mines at densities already labeled unprecedented by several alliance think tanks, deepening the very belts that slowed Ukrainian armor to household walking speed during the first month of the summer counteroffensive. Ukrainian staffs answered by importing additional mine-clearing line charges, ground-penetrating radar kits, and an experimental family of robotic sappers capable of dragging Bangalore torpedoes across open ground. Officials in Kyiv now speak of accelerated drone production lines intended to field large numbers of expendable reconnaissance quadcopters and loitering munitions by mid-year, machines meant to saturate stagnating sectors like Avdiivka with real-time targeting data that might finally fracture the positional deadlock. Moscow pursues a parallel sprint, Russian channels showcase upgraded strike drones they say will soon emerge from expanded domestic factories. Defense industry managers promote a mosquito fleet doctrine. Small, smart, and numerous munitions designed to harass logistics columns that themselves have become more dispersed to evade exact fire artillery. The announcements underscore a strategic convergence. After 23 months of attrition, both belligerents wager that marginal gains in autonomy, battery life, or frequency hopping can yield breakthroughs where battalion-scale assaults have failed. Field reports from Avdiivka already chronicle night skies busy with what soldiers call barn swallows, 1-kilogram quadcopters flitting just below radar coverage, each carrying a single grenade fused to drop on command. These overlapping innovation drives are watched closely in Brussels, Norfolk, and Ramstein because the war is no longer merely a test of wills. It has become the live-fire laboratory reshaping North Atlantic Treaty Organization doctrine. Alliance planners once assumed that their most imminent tasks would be counterinsurgency and low-intensity stabilization. Now they pore over videos of 2-person Ukrainian drone cells disabling multi-million-dollar armored vehicles at ranges once considered safe, and they rewrite procurement spreadsheets accordingly. Senior Allied commanders cite Bakhmut and Robotyne as cautionary parables proving that stockpiles of precision artillery must be far larger and more deeply reserved than pre-invasion playbooks advised. Wargame scenarios inside headquarters now build in assumptions of sustained artillery burn, comparable to the tens of thousands of rounds per month recorded around Bakhmut, and of cyber-electromagnetic contest that can neutralize half a brigade's drones in an afternoon. Diplomats have not surrendered the field to generals. Throughout the past year, Turkey has hosted shuttle dialogues aimed at restoring Black Sea grain corridors. The African Union has floated a phased troop withdrawal scheme contingent on security guarantees. And the Vatican continues back-channel outreach structured around prisoner exchanges and the identification of war dead. None of these initiatives has yet secured a formal ceasefire, but they do serve a secondary function. By keeping doors ajar, they compel both Moscow and Kiev to consider that today's entrenched map might one day convert into lines on a negotiation draft. Ukrainian officials publicly praise the efforts, while privately insisting that talks cannot substitute for further reclaiming ground. The Kremlin maintains that any settlement must reflect realities on the ground, code for territory it still occupies. Progress, if it comes, will therefore depend on whether diplomatic tempo can outrun technological adaptation. For the moment, algorithms evolve faster than communiques. Inside Ukraine, societal resilience still rests on the triad identified in the invasion's first week: grassroots intelligence, leadership continuity, and external backing. Villagers near the Seversky-Donetsk River continue to text license plate numbers to regional hubs. University robotics departments in Lviv prototype sensor suites for mine-clearing crawlers. And nightly television addresses from the presidential compound spotlight new air defense batteries arriving under multi-year grant agreements. This fusion of local initiative and global supply is why Russian territorial gains plateaued in the face of what conventional metrics would call superior mass. It is also why Kremlin planners, after withdrawing from Kyiv in early April 2022, never found a formula that could replicate the shock they achieved on day one. The deadlock's cruelest theater remains the Donbass Arc. Along tree-lined portions of the front, platoons sometimes trade positions twice in a single pre-dawn fog, and then discover at first light that each has reoccupied the same cratered berms they held the week before. United Nations casualty trackers continue to record fatalities at levels unseen in Europe since the late 1990s. Analysts attribute gradual moderation to lessons learned during the siege of Bakhmut, where artillery expenditure climbed to levels that exhausted barrels faster than factories could reline them, prompting both armies to introduce tighter fire discipline tables. Whether the new restraint signals strategic exhaustion or tactical prudence is debated. Either way, the basic geometry of battle has not changed. Artillery pins, drones reveal, and infantry probes. Looking ahead, the most immediate wildcard is mass-produced autonomy. Kyiv hopes that swarms able to loiter for hours and coordinate without continuous human control could upend the trench-line calculus. Moscow bets on similar advances. Observers see in these parallel drives a future where quantity again acquires a quality of its own, but one measured in microchips instead of chassis. Defense journals speculate about follow-on implications for alliance stockpiles and training curricula, yet Ukrainian officers caution that courageous people, not just codes, will still have to enter mine lanes to verify a clearing. Technology may shorten the breach, but it cannot abolish the cost. Economic endurance undergirds all other variables. Ukraine's finance ministry projects a budget gap that multiple foreign grants will still leave partly uncovered, driving an urgency to restart metallurgical plants even within rocket range. Russian economists, working with partial data behind tightened secrecy laws, note that war expenditure absorbs only one-third of federal spending, yet oil revenue and sovereign wealth reserves have so far backfilled much of the deficit. Both economies therefore operate on wartime artifices. Ukraine on Western transfusions, Russia on hydrocarbon lifelines diverted to Asian markets, willing to trade embargo rhetoric for discounted crude. Should either pillar falter, the United Nations map could jitter, but for now the material base on both sides appears solid enough to sustain another cycle of offensives and pauses. As for NATO, the war has already rewritten the alliance's geostrategic grammar. Sweden's accession process, once unhurried, accelerated under the pressure of Baltic vulnerability. Germany's long-debated Zeitenwende funds are financing ammunition plants now contractually obliged to meet Ukrainian burn rates. And frontline member states from Poland to Romania have expanded territorial defense statutes modeled in part on Ukraine's volunteer battalions. Military colleges that once treated high-intensity peer conflict as a theoretical elective now place it at the core of their syllabi, citing Russian mine belts and Ukrainian drone cells as definitive case studies. The war is therefore two conflicts at once, a trench duel grinding across the greater Donbass and a race in workshops, code repositories, and legislative chambers far from the front. Coalition air defense deliveries, Russian drone fabrication drives, and Turkish brokered dialogue rounds each shape events as surely as gun crews sighting their tubes outside Avdiivka. None of these strands alone can decide the outcome. Together, they set the boundary conditions within which battalion commanders plan tomorrow's fire missions. Measured against the dizzying mobility of September 2022 near Kharkiv, the current line may seem inert. Yet within that stillness, capacitors charge, talking points evolve, and alliance doctrines adapt. History teaches that fronts can harden for years before crumbling in a fortnight. Whether such a fracture awaits Ukraine's fourth wartime spring, no prudent analyst will predict. What stands beyond dispute is that every unmoved kilometer on today's map is contested not only by flesh and steel, but by code, finance, and diplomatic stamina. The war that began with cruise missiles over the Dnipro has matured into a multi-domain contest, and its eventual settlement, whenever it comes, will reverberate through the doctrines of NATO, the industrial policies of Europe, and the security imaginations of states far beyond the Black Sea. For now, the horizon remains cauterized by flares and the whine of drones tracing invisible circuits overhead. In the hush that follows each salvo, soldiers on both sides listen for the mechanical buzz signifying either supply drop or lethal glide. That sound, more than any territorial line, defines the war's present tense, the faint electronic hum of innovation pressing against the earthbound weight of trenches. It is the sound of a conflict entering its fourth year, stalemated in space, accelerating in technology, and still, despite every diplomatic overture, refusing to outrun the grip of history. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.